welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. There's a story behind every sheep hunt, and these stories typically involve remote and rugged locations, challenging conditions, and other elements of difficulty that test hunters to their limits. The sheep story in this episode is all of that, and more, times two. Our guests are brothers Ryan and Kenton Claremont, and we hear about their sheep hunting story that really culminated after years of effort and some heartache, which we'll hear about here in this part one of the two-part episodes for Ryan and Kenton's story. There's so much to pull out of this one, whether you're a sheep hunter or not. We talk a bit just about Alaska hunting in general. You know, we're going to Alaska next year for caribou. It's so interesting to hear information about Alaska in general, about these big expeditions like sheep hunting. And Ryan and Kenton have experience on multiple sheep hunts and many other adventures. And we pull some of that out of this. So many lessons. Again, this is a two-part series. We had a long conversation. So much good stuff in it. Hope you guys enjoy it. Before we dive into the episode, I wanted to thank Shane Gunnan for the iTunes review. Shane, email us your shipping information, and we will send you some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry podcast swag. And listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, we just want to hear your feedback. Whether you want us to shoot us an email directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com, or if you can leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher, wherever else you're listening to this, that does help us tremendously. Okay, let's get into part one of this discussion with Ryan and Kenton Claremont. Kenton, Ryan, welcome to the show. Glad to have you guys on.
Yeah, glad to be on, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
I think this is the first tag team of brothers we've ever had.
Well,
you picked a couple good ones.
If I can say so myself.
That's right.
Oh, that's cool, man. Let's go ahead and just, you know, for folks to give context, give some introductions. Ryan, just start with you, just some context on who you are, what you're up to, hunting background, history, things like that.
All right. Well, I grew up in North Idaho hunting the thick mountain country up there for elk and deer. My dad, I think, started taking me out and my brother out as soon as we could walk. Seemed like we were deer hunting mostly with him until we got old enough to be quiet. Then he started taking us elk hunting, but, that's kind of how we got started into hunting. Hunted all the way through high school, went to college, and I missed some hunting seasons in college. But after college, I ended up going on to the military. I served, almost 11 years as a, officer in the Army. And in 2010, I got out of the Army and transferred over to the U.S. Public Health Service Commission Corps. I worked for Indian Health Services in Alaska, ended up moving down to Arizona so my wife could complete her postgraduate degree. Worked for immigration for 3.5, almost 4 years, taking care of undocumented immigrants. And then about 3 years into that job, I got a call from my boss back up in Alaska asking me if I could go back to work for them. I jumped on the opportunity, and now I continue to live in Arizona and work up in Alaska. So because I'm still active duty and I never, you know, gave up my Alaska residency, I continue to be an Alaska resident while I live in Arizona. So hunting wise, I did a lot of hunting when I lived in Alaska. I still go up there and hunt as much as I can. I do a little bit of hunting in Arizona as well. But I really, my passion is getting up to Alaska and hunting up there. Really enjoy the mountain hunts, the ones that, you know, test you. And I guess it's more of the adventure for me these days than it is about getting an animal. But I think that kind of changes as you get older. But this year, I think we're going to do a moose hunt up in Alaska. My dad's retiring this year, finally, after like, I think 43 or 44 years at the same sawmill. And him and I are going to go up to Alaska and hunt moose. So that'll be pretty fun. And then that'll be the first 2 weeks of September. I'll come home, refit for a week, and then off to Idaho with my dad and my brother to do an elk hunt. So it's kind of what I got on the plate this year. And then I think I'll hunt some deer down here in Arizona this winter as well. But that's about it for me.
That's awesome. Kenton, some of the listeners might know you as a previous guest or know you from Train to Hunt. Go ahead and give us a brief intro for those that might not be aware.
Okay, so yeah, Ryan covered a lot of our upbringing. I think the only thing to add to that would be just that, you know, Ryan and I, as far as this podcast is concerned, have always just we were raised, you know, by young parents, and Ryan and I are just under 2 years apart, and so we lived out in the country. We had, you know, we both got bikes at the same time and bows at the same time and BB guns at the same time. And we basically spent our whole childhood as best friends and, you know, running around and shooting anything that crawled, flew, walked. It was fair game. Now, keep in mind, we just had these little recurves and BB guns. So everything, you know, no animals were harmed in this on most of our adventures. But boy, we sure tried. And so yeah, as far as hunting together, Ryan and I have been doing that for a really, really long time. And, you know, Ryan mentioned that dad is a, you know, big, you know, just steeped in tradition as far as like hunting goes and having respect for animals and doing it the right way and learning how to be quiet and, you know, tracking and hunting is just kind of become second nature to us because it's all we ever really did and wanted to do. You know, this is back in the times where there wasn't a ton of TV. There wasn't a ton of computers. We never had, you know, we never had video games or anything like that. So we'd get off the bus and we'd hit, outside and we'd be out there until basically mom called us in at dark. And so, we did a lot of hunting as kids and I got into college and very similar to Ryan, I missed some hunting season during my college time because I was wrapped up in college life and athletics and that kind of thing. And it probably was after I was out of college and Ryan was just, you know, got stationed in Fairbanks, really, Ryan, wasn't it? When you and I just basically decided, hey, let's really reconnect and start hunting again. It was about the time you got stationed in Fairbanks, right?
Yeah, it seemed to be about that time after deployments.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a handful of years in there that I was kind of doing my thing and Ryan was doing his thing and we didn't do a lot of hunting together until after Ryan's deployments we decided to come back together and do our hunting. And the first hunt we did, in fact, was the dull sheep hunt with my dad. So. You know, since that time, we've done, you know, I've started training to hunt. I have, you know, my education is in kinesiology and I have a PE and health teaching certificate. And, I started my own gym in 2008, clear back in 2008, I started a CrossFit gym. About a year into it, I realized that there was I was training all kinds of people with all kinds of goals, mostly just like, you know, make me ripped and skinny. But some were athletes and I knew that, that there were some sports specific movements that went into hunting and that, that as a trainer, I could design a program that was specifically for, somebody who has had these backcountry hunts, planned for the fall. And so started training to hunt and just started providing, you know, the world with with what I believed to be training specifically for hunters. And then a year after Train to Hunt went live on the internet, I started the Train to Hunt Challenge, which is just a it's just a measuring stick. It's an event out there, very similar to like most people at the time were just doing 5Ks and sprint triathlons and what have you. And shooting 3D. And I just decided to mix everything together and say, you know, these are the things I think a hunter should be well-rounded in. And kind of listed those things off as, you know, stamina and power and strength and endurance and mobility and balance, agility, all of the above. You know, they have to be a really well-rounded person in order to be able to go into the mountains confidently for days on end. And so I put that into the event and have been doing that for, this was the eighth season. We just wrapped up our eighth season of the Train to Hunt Challenge. So I've been doing that. And in the mean, you know, between college and now, I've done a lot of things. I was a teacher at a private school. I substitute taught a lot. I've coached wrestling, football, girls softball, baseball. I was a rancher for 6 years while I was getting trained to hunt off the ground. And everything for years and years have always, you know, since I got out of college anyways, revolved around September and hunting the mighty Wapiti. So that's just kind of how my life, I think, like many of your listeners, my life kind of revolves around do what you have to do and can't wait till September gets here.
Yeah, for sure. So we want to talk somewhat specifically about some of the adventures that you two have shared up in Alaska, and some of that's been with your dad as well. Going back to that 2010 hunt, which was the sheep hunt that the three of you did together, before diving into any of that story, Ryan, can you kind of clarify how that works as an Alaska resident, what opportunities you have, and then the opportunities that you can then extend to family in terms of hunting opportunity as an Alaska resident yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So as an Alaska resident, I'll start with a non-resident. There's three species up in Alaska you have to have a guide for. If you do not have a family member of second degree kindred that lives in Alaska who takes you, that is doll sheep, Rocky Mountain goat, and the brown bear or grizzly bear. Those three animals, you have to have a guide or a family member. And second degree kindred is like a brother-in-law. So if my sister's husband was really into hunting, he could come up and I could take him hunting for any one of those three species. Other than that, caribou, black bear, Sitka blacktail, moose, all those can be hunted as a non-resident without a guide. So, yeah, as a resident, I can take my dad, my brother, for doll sheep, mountain goat, and brown bear or grizzly bear.
And is that like a limited entry thing still that they're putting in for? It's pretty much a guaranteed tag.
Oh, it's a guaranteed tag. It's over the counter. Yeah, there are some spots up in Alaska that are draw for each of those species, but there's probably more opportunity over the counter than there is draw. I mean, as far as units go, you can hunt every range for sheep with an over the counter tag.
And is there any way to like pay you a certain fee and get legally adopted into the family?
I've been asked that a few times, as has every other Alaska resident, I'm sure.
It's just crazy to think of, yeah, I'm gonna go get my over-the-counter doll sheep tag now.
I know. Yep. It is. And as a resident too, resident, the fees are pretty easy to come by too. I know that they raised all the rates last year across the board for non-residents. All the tag fees doubled, as well as the license. For a long time, it was $85 for a license, and like a doll sheep tag was $400. Well, come 2017, all those prices are basically doubled. So now it's $800 for a non-resident sheep tag, And it's 160, 165, I think, for a hunting license.
Yeah. And from what I understand, I mean, obviously, anytime you double the price of something, people are not going to be happy. But there hadn't been increases on those numbers in years and years and years, if not decades before then, right?
Right. Yeah. It was probably 25, 30 years before they had seen an increase at all.
Yeah. I mean, thinking of $800 for a dull sheep tag, I mean, that's a non-resident elk tag in some states.
Yeah, right. And a moose tag, for instance, is $850 right now, which is double what it used to be. But still, an $850 moose tag. Anybody who's going to go to Alaska to hunt moose is going to pay $850 without flinching. So,
yeah, I think like non-resident Idaho moose tags, a couple grand at least.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So, this hunt, the three of you, were you hunting just the three of you? You guys and Dad?
Just the three of us, yeah, on this one.
That's amazing. How did that work with, obviously you two take training very seriously, and we can talk more about training later, but with your dad being older, how did you feel about him being in sheep shape, if you will, and did that play into the strategy of the hunt? Were you kind of like limiting certain areas, things like that, or are you pretty confident that, you know, he could hit the hills pretty hard?
I think we were pretty confident. I know he did a little bit of training as much as he could and as much as he knew what to do as far as his training goes. I know he went to the local gym and lifted weights and, you know, did some aerobic classes and spin classes, and he would put weight in his backpack and hike up a hill as much as he could. I don't know how consistent he was doing it, but up until that point, you know, he was always somebody that pushed me and my brother. Like, you know, Dad always walks you into the ground. And up until that point, I hadn't hunted with him too much. And he could always keep up. And at that time, he was 58. He's always been in decent shape. So I don't think we altered our hunt very much at all with him taking his physical abilities into consideration. Now, looking back, I think we should have, because the first three days of hiking, my dad, he was done. He didn't feel like getting out of the sleeping bag the morning of day four. That's for sure. Wouldn't you agree, Kenton?
Yeah, it definitely took a toll on him by day four, and to restate what, you know, basically say what you already said, that is, up to this point, we hadn't all three hunted together for so long. I don't remember the last time we had all hunted together up to that point, how many years it was, but all my memories were, you know, Dad walking us into the ground and having to stop. Even as the college athletes, he'd just be like laughing at us, waiting for us at the top of the hill. So yeah, I agree. We never even considered, you know, we got to go easy on Dad. But yeah, by that fourth day, it was pretty apparent that we probably should have taken a little bit more consideration.
Yeah, I think that's common even for younger guys, and even for hunting terrain that isn't sheep country, is that, you know, you can train hard or you can scoff at training, however you feel about that. But there's something that, you know, you get into, sure, you can hunt hard for a day or two or three, but can you do that day four, five, six, maybe seven, eight, nine, 10 on a sheep hunt? We don't need to go too deep in the weeds, but I'm just curious, Kent, from your perspective with training, how do you prepare for that? Like, how, like, specifically prepare for what might be a 10-day event of just hitting it hard day after day and being able to do that?
Well, I think the first thing you have to consider is that if you're going to train, if you're going to do something for 10 days in a row, you have to just basically plan on having some days in there where they're just not as hard as some other days. Like, you know, you're going to hit the ground hard and want to do a ton of walking and glassing just like we did. And you know, after that first day, you know, that would be considered a pretty high volume workout day. And the next day you might and get up and do something similar to what you did the first day. But by day three, you should probably just plan on day three, like if possible, like if you have, you know, there's a lot of things to consider on for day three, but day three needs to be probably lighter than day one and two, just because if you don't do that, I don't care what kind of shape you're in and how much you prepared. If you're walking, you know, 10, 12 miles a day for 3-4 days in a row, you're going to have some breakdown. You're just not going to be able to keep up nutritionally wise and sleep wise. And you're just not going to be able to recover fast enough, just because there's just so much to consider when you're trying to allow your body to recover. The only thing that makes sense is to have a lighter day where you're, you know, sitting up on a knob and doing some more glassing and if you see a sheep, you're going to go after them. But that, I mean, that's just the way it is. But to back up and answer your question, Mark, I think the only thing you can do is to prepare yourself just, you know, strength wise and, you know, just make sure you're prepared. Your legs are good and strong, you know, doing some squats and deadlifts and some box step ups. And then obviously do as much training in terrain with weight on your back as possible. Do some interval style training where you're given a really strong effort, whether it be 60 to 80, even 90% effort for X amount of time. And then, you know, rest for, you know, say half the time as you worked. So it'd be like 15 minutes on, like maybe 7 minutes off and repeat that, you know, 4 to 8, 10 rounds, and then have days where you just go out and you just try and put one foot in front of the other for, you know, a couple hours. But the strength component is going to be a big one. You want to keep your legs and back strong. Your mobility is going to come into play, you know, at some point where you're going to have to cross creeks and maybe do some scrambling up some rock faces or across some boulder fields, some agility training. You just have to be a really well-rounded training regimen as far as that's concerned. But and then obviously I would do some running too, some running, some biking, some swimming, you know, really build up that stamina, that endurance piece of the training. And then when you get out there, which I think is something that Ryan and I have a really tough time with, and that is just kind of pulling on the reins. You know, we hit the ground and we freaking can't help ourselves but walk for 11 hours the first day, you know? So, it's about, hunt, you know, just kind of managing your hunt so that you have these built-in days where, if possible, this day we're going to, you know, make it a little bit lighter day and just do some glassing and let our bodies kind of recover from, you know, the searching days, if we'll call them, you know, where we had plenty of those in our three hunts. So, just do your due diligence. Try to train every day. I would say, you know, every day try to do something, even if it's a light walk. And then a couple times a week, you know, you want to do something pretty intense as far as strength and power is concerned. And then at least one time a week, you want to put on a heavy pack and walk for, you know, an hour, really heavy pack, and walk, you know, as fast as you can so that, you know, you're building up those muscles and hips and stabilizer muscles, feeling that weight on your back, and you can adapt a little bit. Your body will adapt to any demand you put on it. It just takes some time and you have to be patient with it. So, hopefully that answers your question, Mark.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. The interesting thing I think specifically about like an Alaskan sheep hunt is that a lot of times those rest and recovery days are forced on you, because at some point almost it seems like the weather's going to keep you in the tent maybe for a day or two.
Yeah. Luckily we had one of those. We've only had one of those in three sheep hunts.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. We've been pretty lucky, but man, we needed it.
Yeah. Wow. So let's stick on this hunt with your dad years ago. I don't want to skip all the story, but we have other hunts we also want to talk about as well. I'm just curious to jump to the end. It sounds like the outcome was somewhat disappointing, mixed with emotions, mixed with results. Ryan, what happened on this hunt? What did you guys take away from it?
We took away a few things from it. As far as the actual feet on the ground hunt goes, I think the biggest takeaway for me was food. I don't think any of us, me included, had our nutrition dialed in, our backcountry nutrition. So that was a big takeaway, because from day number one, I was hungry. The first time we stopped to have a snack, I literally could have eaten everything, my whole day's worth of food. I could have eaten it right there. I was really hungry. So that was the number one takeaway. And there were days in that hunt where, I didn't really want to go hiking at all because I had zero energy. I had very little food. We ran out of food because our plane was late. So on those days that we knew we were just going to hang out all day, I couldn't muster up enough energy to even go look for sheep, and we still had two more tags to fill.
So was it just the number of calories or the type of calories? Like, getting specific, what do you do differently now?
I think it's just the number of calories. I do a lot of things different now, where I research food a lot more. I pack a lot higher calorie dense food. I think there's better food out there now than there was, 8 years ago. But the biggest thing I do differently is the caloric dense food, like foods that are high in fat, would probably be my number one thing. But I think that the other big thing I took away was what Kenton was talking about. You can't hit the ground and hike for 12 hours, wake up and repeat too many days in a row before you're just going to bonk. And that's what happened to my dad. You know, the day he couldn't get out of his sleeping bag was the day we had some rams spotted. And that day, Ken and I got up, we had the rams in sight, and right from camp, and my dad couldn't get out of his sleeping bag. And this whole hunt was just to get my dad a sheep. This is something he's been dreaming about forever, since he's been hunting, is to go sheep hunting, whether it was bighorn sheep or doll sheep, it didn't matter. He just wanted to go sheep hunting. So when you have a guy who's, reaching 60 years old and finally getting to do the one hunt he's been wanting to do for probably the better part of his life, and he's got a sheep in sight from camp, and he doesn't want to get out of his sleeping bag, that right there kind of drilled home to my brother and I that we worked him way too hard, and we were spent too, but obviously with us being a lot younger than him, we were able to recover quite a bit faster. So that was another takeaway I think we pushed into our next two sheep hunts. And then the big one, I think what you're kind of relating, talking about, Mark, is the fact that we went from being so excited for my dad that he killed a sheep. Even though Kent and I didn't get a sheep, mission was accomplished. And in Alaska, the first thing you should do when you hit the ground back in Fairbanks or wherever you're at is get your horn sealed. You have to have your horn sealed by Fish and Game. The legal rules in Alaska are that the sheep has to be 8 years old, so 8 growth rings, or full curl on one side. And the third scenario is that the sheep is broomed or broken off on both antlers, so, or both horns. We thought for sure that my dad's sheep was full curl. We all confirmed it before he shot it. And even up to the point where we went to Fish and Game and we're getting his horn sealed, we still thought it was full curl. About 45 minutes to an hour, and I would say 4 different people coming in the room and looking at it. And it was split. 2 people thought it was good. 2 people didn't think it was good. Long story short, they ended up deciding that the sheep was like an eighth of an inch away from full curl, 7 years old, and it was not broomed. And therefore they cited, uh, they gave my dad a citation for shooting an illegal ram. So we hit very quickly. We hit rock bottom, and the sheep was taken away. We had to turn in all the meat, turn in the horn. They kept the horns. We had to take it over to the Alaska State Troopers. And my dad was given a citation and a court date. The good news is, out of all that, I guess it's good news, is that when my dad called in for the court date, it was dropped because this Alaska Fish and Game did not file the citation. So my dad didn't have to pay any fines, and he didn't get his license taken away, or he didn't get cited anything. The bad news about that was the horns were gone. My dad, that was the question he asked, well, what about the horns? And he was told they were gone. So he didn't ever get his sheep back.
Man, that is so tough. Like, within an eighth of an inch, and even having Fish and Game personnel there thinking it was full curl and kind of vouching for that, that is a tough situation.
Yeah, it was a very, very hard pill to swallow, and it was tough. It was the first time my dad has ever been cited for anything in his life, and it was tough, man. It was a tough day.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, as you guys mentioned, you were confident. You had all three verified it. But going into future trips, how did that change your perspective on making those judgment calls? I mean, clearly you're confident the first time, but now are you just overly cautious?
For sure. Yeah, for sure. It was, you could say that. I mean, so our next sheep hunt was 3 years later in 2013. My brother and a good buddy of mine, Terry Bateman, who lives in Alaska right now, I met up there when I was living up there. We all three went on a sheep hunt together. We all drew straws because there was three of us. We're trying to figure out who's going to shoot first, second, and third. And so we just put numbers 1, 2, and 3 in a hat, and everybody drew a number. And so day one, if you drew number one, you got day one. If you drew number two, you got day two. And then, if you drew number three, you got day three, and then it would just keep rotating. Well, Terry drew number one, Kenton drew number two, and I drew number three. And the very first night opening, well, it was actually August 9th at around midnight, 11 o'clock, we spotted a ram that we'd seen, a couple days before that. We got in to the mountains a couple days early to do some scouting, and we thought he was broomed on both sides when we, had first seen him, but we weren't quite sure, if he was or not. We knew he was broomed on one, but we needed to get a better look at him if he was broomed on the other side. So, long story short, we hiked up the mountain and made a stalk on him and got within 300 yards. And it was about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning when we finally got above him, but it was August 10th, and so it was legal. But we sat on that ram from about 12:30 till, I think Terry ended up pulling the trigger finally at about 5:30 in the morning. So we sat for 4 hours at 300 yards looking through an 80 millimeter spotting scope, making sure he was broomed on both sides.
Wow.
And that's the level of caution that I took away from that first hunt. There was no way I was ever going to wanted to go through that feeling again. But he ended up shooting that ram. We took it back. And then day two, my brother ended up killing a ram. And that hunt ended with me having a tag in my pocket for, I think, 6 or 7 days. And we just could never find another legal ram.
Wow. That's after getting two in 2 days, you had to be feeling pretty good and pretty confident. Oh, man, I got 5, 6 days. No problem. Let's do this.
Yeah, we thought we had it in the bag. We thought we were going to come home with three sheep for sure. I mean, we had no doubt. And as the days went on and the days got longer and the sheep got fewer and fewer, man, the reality started becoming true that, gosh, we may not get this third ram. It was crazy. Yeah, crazy.
Wild. So 2017, this past year, was, I know, a redemption type hunt for you. In those years in between, were you just not hunting sheep at all? Was that not an option?
Yeah, I just wasn't able to hunt sheep, just mainly because in 2012, actually, it was that year that I relocated to Arizona. So it was just,
it was harder.
Yeah, it was the move. I was working for immigration. I wasn't working up in Alaska. So yeah, there's a lot of obstacles.
Yeah. I'm curious. So going into last year's hunt, it was just going to be the two of you, Ryan and Kenton. From a high level, you know, not knowing much about sheep, as I'm sure our listeners are learning as well, how do you guys scout sheep country? I mean, it's so big. It's so vast. I know you end up covering so much ground, but at the same time, leading into a hunt, are you even using tools like Google Earth to pick up drainages or certain areas? And if so, what are you looking for?
Yeah. So, Google Earth, I'd talked to some fish and game guys, and I've got, some friends who do more sheep hunting than I do. And just looking at the Brooks Range, you know, the sheep in the Brooks Range, if you look at the Brooks from east to west, they tend to be on the far east of the Brooks Range, most of the sheep are on the northern Brooks Range. And as you, the further west you go, they kind of, are more on the southern portion of the Brooks Range. So I knew that going into the scouting for the 2017 hunt. I knew that I wanted an area, a drainage that I wanted to hunt. I've been wanting to get up there since our very first hunt, just based on the remoteness of it and the potential for there being some good sheep in there. But when scouting on Google Earth, you know, those bigger rams, they really don't need a lot of those grassy hills that you'll see a lot of the younger rams and ewes and lambs in. Because ewes and lambs and the younger rams, they'll be all over those rolling grassy knobs where there's tons of feed. They're up high. They're away from predators for the most part. And you got water pretty close by. Those bigger rams, they'll be up in the rocky stuff. And, you know, if you can just look on Google Earth and see just a little bit of greenery up in the rocks, then that's enough for those bigger rams. And they only come down for water maybe once every other day or so. So they can, you know, they're just a lot smarter and a lot more efficient at movement, and they don't waste a lot of energy running around, especially before the rut happens, which is typically up there, it's October or so. So usually hunting dall sheep in August, and they don't move around a lot in that time of year. So, but as far as scouting goes, it's, you know, there's not a lot you can do. You do a lot of it, I'd say, once you get on the ground and really look around and figure out what the terrain looks like, where you're seeing a lot of ewes and lambs, where you're seeing younger rams. You just that was another thing we learned from the very first sheep hunt is if you're seeing a lot of ewes and lambs and little rams, you're not going to see a big ram. So you need to go up the drainage more or get higher, where those bigger rams will hang out usually by themselves, or they may be in, you know, small bands of one to three or four maybe. But not, you know, there's just knowing where sheep, what range sheep are in. You can do a little bit of Google Earth reconnaissance, but there's really not a whole lot you can do until you get on the ground. And I think that's pretty true for anything.
How are the logistics of flying in? Is that pretty good access, pretty good opportunities where if you have your eye in a certain area, you can go to the pilot and basically ask, how close can you get me here? Is he more restrictive on telling you, you know, sorry, here's what I can and can't do?
I think pilots vary. I've talked to a few pilots up there, and they're pretty open. They're not going to come right out and tell you exactly where every airstrip is up there. You have to come to them with, hey, this is a drainage I'm thinking about going to. Do you have any airstrips in this location? They usually will tell you if they do or don't. And that's how this hunt kind of unfolded. I went, because I work up in Alaska, I fly out to villages a lot. So I use an air service called Right Air Service. And they also take hunters out quite a bit. So I knew the guy who ran that operation as far as the hunting side of the house. And so I'd go in and talk to him whenever I was waiting for a flight. And we got to talking about where I wanted to be dropped off. And he said he thought there was an airstrip there, but he would have to have some of his guys go and check it out. And so when it was all said and done, he did verify that strip was there, and he was able to get us into it. But I would say for guys, you know, researching airstrips or locations in Alaska, yeah, and calling air taxi services, definitely figure out the drainage, the area you want to go into, and just pick up the phone and call. And I've never been turned down from any of those guys. It's their business. They want your business. So, just pick up the phone and call them and talk to them about airstrips. Most of the guys that have been flying up there, for years know exactly where the airstrips are, and they know where their buddies are flying too. And so it's always a good thing to go with a guy who's not going to drop you on top of a bunch of people too.
Yeah. Kenton, I'm curious from your perspective, what things come to mind in terms of a lower 48 guy going up for his first Alaskan adventure? I know, you know, we've already kind of covered training a little bit specifically, but what else do they not think of that they need to be thinking of if they're heading up to, whether that's a sheep hunt or something else, but this kind of big expedition adventure style hunt in Alaska?
Well, one of the things that comes to mind, and I think most people do it a pretty good job of it down in the lower 48, is definitely be prepared for anything. Like for example, our first sheep hunt, I was going to mention Ryan, you know, talking about these logistics and Google Earth and scouting and Ryan is second to none in my opinion. He's like the guy. He likes to do it. He enjoys it, and therefore he is really, really good at it. But we, you know, sometimes things just don't work out. So you got to be prepared for anything. Our first sheep hunt, we had everything, had the maps for everything, had everything dialed in. And, you know, we went into camp and we got fogged in a couple of days. Finally, the guys were like, well, we can't drop you where you wanted to be dropped, but we can drop you in this drainage. And so we were been sitting in camp for 2 days. So we said, just get us, is there sheep there? Yes. Just get us out there. So, it played out that we got dropped in a place. We had no maps. We didn't have anything. We had no idea. We hadn't done any research in this area. We just knew that there was sheep there and that we were going to walk them down. And, you have to be prepared for anything. You have to be prepared weather wise. You have to be prepared mentally. You have to be prepared to hit the ground and really grasp the idea that everything is going to be twice as far as you think it's going to be, twice as steep as you think it's going to be, according to the map and Google Earth. And it's going to be take what you figure how hard or how steep and how far this location is going to be and basically double it, because that's just the reality of Alaska, is that everything's just bigger than life. You're not going to overpack food. I guess if there was one real takeaway from me, I would say don't short yourself on food. You're never going to regret packing food out. Like we did the last couple of trips. The first trip, we ran out of food like 3 days before we got picked up. And the only reason we ran out that late in the trip was because we just were disciplined and not eating all our food at once. So, make sure do your research on food, do your research on gear. If you think it might, like it, if you think it might rain, it'll probably snow. If you think there's no chance it's going to rain, then it's probably going to pouring down rain on you. In fact, I got a funny story about that. Ryan knows exactly what story I'm going to tell. We were on our second hunt with Terry. And so the first hunt, I already told you, we got dropped in. We didn't have any maps or anything. The second time we got dropped 11 miles from where we thought we were going to be dropped. And so we took off. The plane dropped us. We took off and pulled out the maps and started looking around. And we were like, whoa, I thought they were going to drop us here, not here. And so basically that first day, we spent the entire day just getting to where we were initially thinking we were going to be dropped. So there's that monkey wrench. And so we walked. How long was it, Ryan? Like 11 hours? We walked full packs for about 11 hours. And the last probably 2 hours of that, we had to walk a mile to the river and then turn around. And then we decided just go up, get up into the mountains. We saw some sheep and we were just like, let's just go up right here instead of walking the next few miles and camping where we thought we were going to be dropped. We go up this mountain. I don't know how far. We got up there quite a ways and finally it leveled off. It was about 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. Kind of leveled off. We were all just beat, ready to just sleep. And I made the suggestion, hey, why don't you know what? Let's just all beat. It's pure blue skies out. Let's just sack out here and get up early and make the rest of the climb in the morning. And Ryan and Terry luckily convinced me, no, man, let's throw up a tent. Like the weather can change pretty quickly. And I was convinced that we were wasting our time because it was nothing but stars. I mean, it was nothing but blue skies. It was like, no way it's going to, but okay, let's throw up the tent and it'll give us a good chance to, you know, to boil the water and stuff. And so we threw up a tent and what was it? Maybe 3 hours later, I woke up and we were, and it was pouring down rain and it was trying to blow us off the mountain, Mark. Jeez. Like it was sideways rain. Remember that, Ryan? Just like,
oh yeah.
Crazy. Of course, they kind of wake me up and they're both laughing and I'm like, what? I think the world's collapsing on me. I'm like, why is the tent like right in my face? And I realized, oh, it's like the wind's blowing, you know, 60 miles an hour and it's sideways raining out there. And of course, Ryan and Terry go, yeah, guys, let's just throw our sleeping bags on the ground and not worry about it. So, but let that be a lesson to anybody who's going up that way is that no matter what, rain gear, like be prepared for snow, rain, all the elements, regardless of what the forecast is calling for, and bring more food than you think you're going to eat.
Well, that's a wrap for part one, guys. I hope you tune in next week and catch part two. We get into, obviously, the rest of their adventure and all kinds of crazy stories. So it's super exciting stuff. So be sure to tune back in. Hit that subscribe button. As always, if you have feedback, shoot us an email, podcast@exomountgear.com.